Date is August 9th, 1985, and my name is Mark Hill. Well, let's continue on from the saga of the Nabob.
I left that just after the three remaining Canadians that were still on board clearing up the affairs and with turning over the ship to an RN care and maintenance crew. And we had just experienced a fire in the damaged portion. A few days later, we left and went to Greenock in Scotland on the Clyde west coast, and we were accommodated in HMCS Niobe, which was the Canadian depot in the British Isles. It was a former insane asylum and hadn't lost some of its previous characteristic when we stayed there. We weren't particularly popular because about 500 of our men had been processed through and sent back to Canada, and apparently they hadn't all behaved to the satisfaction of the commanding officer. The commanding officer of Niobe at that time was Captain Eustace Brock from Winnipeg.
I'm sure that name gave rise to a lot of nicknames, I'm sure.
Yes. which the favorite was Useless.
Yeah.
And he was terribly serious and terribly salty for a shore establishment, whereas the majority of us were rather relaxed. But one day I happened to be talking to his secretary. I was anxious to find passage back to Canada, and somebody shouted out to the officer of the day, have the captain's boat alongside. So I thought this ought to be interesting, seeing that we're perched up on a hill. And there were various pipes and shouts, and the side party, bosun's mate and the petty officer of the day and the officer of the day and various people. And Captain Brock emerged. A staff car, a rather beaten up one, drew up at the door. And he stalked out carrying a silver-headed cane and looking very dapper. And the pipes shrilled as he went through the front door, as they do when somebody leaves or boards a ship. And there was much saluting and everything, and I could just stand there and shake my head. And I thought, gee, these fellows are very salty. Well, we stayed there, I guess, pretty close to a week. And then we were, the three of us, Collins, Parks, and I, were given passage in the Queen Mary to New York. Queen Mary at that point was carrying American wounded in the main. There were about 1,500 of them. And there were other, there was the future commander of the British Eastern Fleet. What was his name? I forget at the moment. But anyway, he was on board with his staff. And there was a number of entertainers who were going to on a tour of the United States. Originally, we were put down in a 20-berth cabin way down in the bowels of the ship. We didn't think very much of that. The Queen Mary carried a whole division when it was coming eastward, which was around 15,000 men, and they had the warm bunk routine where you were allocated an 8-hour period to sleep and the rest of the time you were up. Well, we didn't think much of that 20-berth cabin. So we protested violently to the naval commandant, he was called. There was an army, an air force, and a navy commandant. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, I think I can fix you up. Well, I was a commander at the time. The other two were lieutenants. But I was moved into a cabin on the promenade deck, which was just adjacent to the area where the wounded were. They were all bed cases, and I found that we had fresh water in our bathroom. Well, now that was something, because everywhere else there were just salt water showers. Mm-hmm. I was sharing this cabin with an RN commander who was going to the United States on some technical job, and a colonel of the U.S. Army, Colonel Seitz, who had been a OSS man in Yugoslavia working with Mihailovich. Now, Mihailovich was opposed to Tito, and eventually he was, but he was a great enthusiast for Mihailovich, but he was a most interesting man and regaled us with stories of what went on and behind the scenes. We had an uneventful trip to New York, except that it took 7 days, which is rather longer than the normal passage, because we were diverted on a number of occasions. We were busting along at 29 knots, but we were diverted way down south to avoid submarine concentrations. Mm-hmm. And we arrived in New York, and I took the train the same night to Montreal, where my wife met me. She'd come from the West Coast and was staying with my mother in Ottawa. And after I'd checked into Naval Headquarters, I went on a month's leave, which was my annual leave, and 2 weeks survival leave, which we all got from NABUB. Mm-hmm. stayed in Ottawa some of the time, and we went to New York for a few days and Montreal, and I was very glad to be home. The question, at that point, I had my interview for transfer to the regular Navy, the RCN, and that had its funny side, because the chairman was Captain Grant, who had been the chief of personnel, and a few others, and he said to the other members, I think there were five all told, you better ask some questions. So Captain Cross, another RCNVR, he was the director of demobilization, and he said, would you tell me what you think of your demobilization plans? So I said, well, I've never heard of them. Nobody's ever told us anything. I said, I explained that although I was amongst a great number of Canadians, it was an RN ship, and nobody came around and said anything about what would happen when the war was over. So with that, Captain Grant said, well, I told you, Paul, that you're not doing the job properly. And for the next 10 minutes, these characters were arguing amongst themselves, and I was sitting silently at the end of the table. So finally, Captain Grant said, well, I guess we all know, Charles, you wait outside. So that was all the questions I was asked. So I went out, and I wondered how things were going, and I could hear them laughing inside. And I said to secretary there, I said, what do I do now? He said, you better wait. So So a few minutes later, the door opened and they called me in. They said, okay, you've been accepted. They said, have you any questions? I said, yes, I do have one. I said, I'm 2.5 months away from qualifying for my volunteer decoration, which was a wooden medal that you were given, and for service in the reserve. And you had to have 20 years service, but wartime counted double. So I said, could I delay my switch over to the RCN 2.5 months, because I said I'd like to have C.J. Dillon V.D. after my name. Oh, we'll see what we can do for you. You got to be switch over right away. So I never heard another thing. I didn't get my volunteer decoration. But anyway, I had my uniforms changed to straight stripes, and I sat around Ottawa waiting for something to happen. Well, it ended up that I had rather longer than 30 days leave, because they couldn't make up their mind where to send me, but eventually they said that I was to go to St. John's, Newfoundland, to the naval base there, which was called HMCS Avalon, and that I was to go immediately, and I was to become the senior supply officer for the base. Mm-hmm. So I said, all right. And I flew from Ottawa to St. John's by way of Moncton. And we had a terrible flight. It was in a thing called a Lockheed Lodestar, an Air Force plane, and there were icing conditions, and it was a very dicey flight, in my opinion. Eventually, I landed up in St. John's, and I stayed for, that was about the middle of November, and I stayed in the hotel until I was able to scratch around, find somewhere to live. My wife stayed in Ottawa with our young son, who was then only 14 months old. I don't think I turned over any, you know, the fellow who preceded me had gone on his way. And my working office was in the Buckmaster's Field Complex, which was the Naval Barracks, a large place. We had at that time about 10,000 men, officers, men, and wrens in the base staff, and this mm-hmm. was quite separate from the people afloat in the escort groups. Mm-hmm. And St. John's was a very alive base. We existed solely for the support of the ships at sea, and we weren't bothered by a lot of ceremonial and fancy waistcoats. It was strictly work. Mm-hmm. On Christmas Day 1944, my wife joined me. I had to get permission to bring her because there was a quota on the number of dependents allowed in, and housing in St. John's was terrible, but I managed to find a temporary accommodation, and we actually stayed in three different houses. The weather was frightful. Everything happened. We'd have freezing rain, snow, sunshine, all in a 24-hour period. Mm. And the living expenses were very high. Mm-hmm. The only thing that was cheap in St. John's were taxis and liquor. You could go anywhere in St. John's for a dollar in a taxi. It didn't matter whether it was around the block or whether it was from one end to the other. The other thing was liquor. Everything was $4 a bottle. It didn't matter what the brand was. It could be Johnny Walker Black Label, mm-hmm. or Screech, the rum. The just $4 a.
Now, when this is what? This is the winter of 44?
45.
45.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In May, of course, we had VE Day.
Yeah.
And we had various interesting things that occurred. The submarine U-190 surrendered to our ships off coast of Newfoundland, and she was brought into Bay Bulls, which was a little base we had just west of St. John's, and then brought into St. John's Harbor. And we had the crews who were treated as prisoners of war.
Mm-hmm.
We had a big parade the morning of VE Day on the parade ground at Avalon. It was short. There were usual prayers and a march past, and everybody said how pleased they were the war was over there, but it wasn't really, because we still had the Japanese to compete with.
Mm-hmm.
And the point I want to make is that, quite unlike Halifax, where they had the riots and everything went wrong, we had been planning for a period of 2 weeks what would happen on VE Day. We knew it was coming.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know when.
Yeah.
And there were various precautions that were taken. For example, all the officers' wardrooms or messes were closed. There would be no sale of liquor at all, and the officers were all required on duty to as fire pickets and to look after any problems.
Mm-hmm.
We had an open gangway. People could go down the town if they wanted, but St. John's wasn't a very exciting city. And there were no pubs in St. John's, but liquor was easily obtainable from the government liquor stores, and I've no doubt bootleggers. It didn't bother us in that aspect, because prior to VE Day, we could get liquor at duty-free prices from the mess.
Mm-hmm.
We had one very good arrangement, unlike Halifax, that they kept a whole bunch of lockers in the guardhouse at the barracks. And the troops could go ashore and buy a bottle, but they didn't have to drink it all before they came home,
mm-hmm.
so as not to waste it. They could bring it in, and they could put it in a locker marked at the right level. And then the next time they went out, they could get it back. And this helped very much.
Mm-hmm.
We also had accumulated 2,500 cases of beer. That was quart bottles of beer,
mm-hmm.
Canadian beer, in our St. John's Naval Canteen. And it had been a going concern for, well, since the base was opened in 1941 or 42. So they had lots of profits, and it was decided that we would issue free beer to everybody, and we organized dances and all sorts of entertainment. Well, by 3 o'clock in the afternoon on VE Day, there wasn't a single sailor downtown. They were all in the barracks or on board ships. The ships, of course, had to take special precautions. For example, the all ammunition lockers and pyrotechnic mm-hmm. lockers were padlocked And the captain personally was responsible for the keys, because they were afraid that people would get over enthusiastic and start firing off rockets and mm-hmm. even guns and set fire to the city, which was very flammable. Mm. But there was no problem there. Everything went very well.
So why didn't they do these types of things in Halifax?
A good question. Mm. I don't know. I wasn't there. But yeah. They sure didn't do anything right there. Mm-hmm. We had a court-martial scheduled for that day for a couple of people who committed an offense. And I had been appointed the prosecutor because I'd been involved with a lot of courts-martial. This was the first time I was a prosecutor. And the court-martial was supposed to start at 10 o'clock in the morning, but of course we had other things to do. So it didn't start till 5 in the afternoon, and it lasted until midnight. And I'm happy to say that I got a conviction on both of them, and they were dismissed the service, because their ship had to sail the next morning, and we needed the witnesses, and we had to get on with it. The result was that I got home for the first time that day at midnight, and I was able to have a drink with my wife to celebrate VE Day, and that was it. Then we started to, well, convoy escort continued for a further 2 weeks after VE Day, because nobody trusted the Germans.
Yeah.
And they were afraid that some fanatical U-boats would keep on the war. But it didn't occur. Mm. Another one was brought in to Shelburne, Nova Scotia, the U-889. And most of the others were taken into British ports in Northern Ireland or Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then they... process of running down the base started and continued through the remainder of May, June, and early in July my wife and young son left and flew back to Ottawa, and I was there for a short time into July. And then I took passage in one of the frigates from St. John's to Quebec City. We went up to St. Lawrence. I think the ship was the Glace Bay. I was given a bunk or a bed on a settee in the captain's day cabin. And for some reason or other, the darn thing was infested with fleas. And I was eaten alive, which didn't please me very much, but anyway. But I got to Quebec City and went up to Ottawa to report to headquarters, joined my wife. And at that point, we'd gone through this nonsense about re-volunteering for the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, members of the regular force didn't have to volunteer. We'd done that a dozen times, and we'd committed ourselves to serve anywhere. We didn't mind whether it was this way or that way. But it caused a lot of, tooth-sucking by people. But I always remember Commodore Taylor, who was the head man. He was a flag officer of Newfoundland. This was one of Mackenzie King's brilliant inventions. And anybody who volunteered for the Pacific would get another 30 days leave. Well, that was popular. On the other hand, there were thousands of people who just wanted to pack it up and go back to civil life again.
Mm-hmm.
I went into the flag officer's office one day and talked to his secretary, and I said, "What's the boss man doing about volunteering?" He said, "Well, I brought him the form that you had to sign." And he said, if this is going to make them any happier, I'll sign it. And, of course, that word spread quickly, and there were no problems with the regulars. And a great many of our reserve people volunteered for the Pacific. Some didn't for various reasons. It was their own decision. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I was due to go to Northern Ireland, to Belfast, to join the aircraft carrier Magnificent as supply officer. And she was fitting out there. Mm-hmm. But I had 60 days leave, my annual leave, which I hadn't had, and my Pacific leave. Mm-hmm. So my wife and I decided to go back out to the West Coast, out here, and we would stay with her parents up on Salt Spring Island. And I had to take a course. We'd introduced the new pay system, which was a giant step forward on the old one. And I had to take a short course in Naden on how it worked. So we got on the train, and I can assure you that train travel in those days was no joy. The trains were terribly crowded. And, of course, you had to move your family at your own expense. Mm-hmm. You had to line up for meals. And there were long waits. And it was no fun traveling with a child of 2 years or so. Mm-hmm. However, we made it and got out here all right. And I went and took my week's course. But on the way, as we came down the Fraser Canyon, was VJ Day. They'd dropped the big bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And that obviously raised a lot of doubts if we were going out to the Pacific or not. And after the course, I went up to Salt Spring Island. And I started my leave, and I had exactly 11 days when the telephone rang and said, "Your appointment to the Magnificent is canceled. We want you to leave immediately for Sydney, Nova Scotia." Now, you know, Sydney was almost where I'd left in the first instance. St. John's, Newfoundland isn't that far. Yeah. So I didn't have any leave beyond 10 days, 11 days. And I went off. I got on the train in Vancouver, and I spent 5 days and six nights on the train getting to Sydney. Sydney was a good base. It was had been built up during the war, and it was across the harbor at Point Edward from the town or city of Sydney. And the surroundings were quite pleasant. And the well, I left my wife and child on the West Coast, and I lived in the wardroom. And I had been told by my masters in Ottawa that I would be there for 2 years, that it was going to be a permanent post-war base. Mm-hmm. Well, our job at that time, and I got there in, it was the end of August, I guess, was we were taking corvettes, minesweepers, and all sorts of other ships, and destoring them and removing the armament. And then they were towed up the St. Lawrence River, where they were being disposed of to various outfits. Some were scrapped, some were kept, some were transferred to commercial uses. And it was a busy base, but the whole place kept falling down around my ears. people would come in and say, well, I'm off today, I'm being demobilized, and I began to wonder whether I was going to be there 2 years or not. At the end of about 6 weeks, I had a phone call from headquarters in Ottawa that I was to come up for a conference to discuss future problems. So I planned for that as going up and coming back. And about 2 days before I was due to leave, I got another phone call that told me to turn over my job to the next senior supply officer, and that I was coming to Ottawa to stay. So I did just that. In the meantime, I tried to rent some housing, and I'd found an apartment on top of a furniture store right in the town of Sydney, and I'd almost closed the deal when they told me that I was going to Ottawa to stay. So I had to get myself out of that. And I got to Ottawa, and I stayed with my mother. And I found that I was to be the director of Naval Air Supply, which was a new job that they concocted at headquarters. And of course, headquarters was in a real state of confusion at that point, because people were leaving and people were arriving from various places, and you know, the demobilization thing was going great guns. But we just started our own Fleet Air Arm side, mm-hmm. and obviously somebody had to look after the nuts and bolts. I took over an empty office, it had previously been occupied by some technical outfit, but the officer whose desk I took over was Lieutenant Rubin, RCNVR. Some months later, when the Guzenko thing broke, mm-hmm. and they hauled in a bunch of people, Mr. Rubin was one of them. And he'd been involved deeply in this, so I don't know what secrets he gave away.
Yeah.
But in the course of things, he was arrested, but he was never tried. And when they let him out, he disappeared behind the Iron Curtain, and as far as I've been able to glean ever since, he's still there. So I don't know what Mr. Rubin's thing was, but that was...
Now, what was his position? He wouldn't have been director of...
No, he wasn't director of anything, but he was working in some anti-submarine... in the production of equipment, and the... At the time, I didn't take a great interest in what he did. I just knew it was his desk I'd mm-hmm. taken over. Mm-hmm. Well, then they added another job to mine. I wore two hats, which was director of fleet stores. And I was in that from, November 45... through to 1947. And of course, at that time, most of our work was on running the Navy down, mm-hmm. declaring stores surplus. On the air side, it was building up because we were starting from scratch. Mm-hmm. But on the fleet stores side, we were getting rid of stuff. And in the winter of 1947, The United States Navy had invited us to send some observers on a fleet exercise, which was being held in the Atlantic. And there were a number of people who told off to go. I was one of them, and on the logistics side, and Admiral Sterling, who lives here and probably been one of the people that had been interviewed, he was in one of the aircraft carriers, the Leyte, and there were others. So I went down to Norfolk, Virginia, and checked in there, and I was allocated to a fleet oiler replenishment ship called the USS Chuckawan, which was a big 25,000-ton fleet oiler, something like the Provider. And I spent, we went off as part of the Atlantic Fleet Service Force, which followed the strike fleet. The strike fleet made up of a number of aircraft carriers. There was the Leyte, and there were a couple of others, and there were ammunition ships, and no, there were cruisers and destroyers and submarines, too. And the exercise area was between the U.S. coast off Norfolk and the Azores. We whistled around there for a month without going into anywhere, but every two or three days we replenished the ships. I was after 10 days in the fleet oiler, which was an interesting experience. I was transferred to a ship which was a store ship. It was actually an AKA, which is combat cargo ship. And I spent 5 or 6 days aboard her, and then I was transferred to an ammunition ship, the Great Sitkin. And all these transfers were done by jackstay, which I'd never done before. And the first time I went, when I arrived on the receiving ship, they said, "Where's your life jacket?" Well, I said, "Nobody suggested I should wear one." Apparently it was a must. because you bounced around. I think there were some pictures in the album I produced. And then I was in a provision ship, the Aldebaran refrigerator ship, and we used to dispense things to destroyers and cruisers and battleships. The Big Missouri was there, the Mighty Mo. I finally wound up in, it was a short time at a destroyer, and then I wound up in the USS Fargo, which was a cruiser. And we, at the end of a month, we peeled off from the fleet and went back to New York. And I came back to Canada. Well, I wrote a great long report on this, on all the various methods of replenishment at sea. And it was very valuable, and actually there weren't too many people who had very much interest in this whole business of replenishment at sea. And the staff rather took an interest in the thing that I produced. And I'd had In these various ships that I was in, there was a captain and a chief petty officer from the U.S. Navy from the photographic side. And they very kindly gave me copies of all their photographs, so I was able to illustrate my report with detailed pictures. Hmm. Copies of which I kept.
Of course.
And eventually, that 1947, 1 month at sea of the USN, resulted in, not entirely through my efforts, but the start in the provider, the protector, and the preserver.
Right.
So, you know, we joined the club. Hmm. Well, then, in August 1947, I was a commander still. I was appointed Naval Secretary. Well, the Naval Secretary is also the Secretary of the Naval Board, and he's the sort of administrative head of the Naval Headquarters thing. Having a person in that type of job is unique for the Navy, and it was something we had obviously adopted from the Royal Navy, but in the Royal Navy it was a civilian, whereas with us it was an officer's job. It was one of the most interesting appointments in my whole career, because you certainly knew what was going on. You were sort of bathing in the saliva of the horse's mouth, and it was a very interesting period. The chief of naval staff at that time was Admiral Grant, who was my old boss. Mm-hmm. And when I was director of Naval Air Supply and director of Fleet Stores, he'd been the chief of naval equipment and supply. So I sort of was under his mantle for a long time, starting when I was his secretary during the early days of the war, when he was chief of personnel. And he was a very fine officer. He was a very active and able person. And happily, I got on very well with him. All sorts of trials and tribulations were the order of the day during my stint as Naval Secretary. One little incident to go back. In 1947, Brooke Claxton became the minister, and he was another live wire. In my opinion, he's the best Minister of Defense we ever had. Mm-hmm. Some of them have been real boobs, but he was a real go-getter. His military experience was not that great. He'd been a sergeant in the McGill Siege Battery in World War I. Mm-hmm. But I knew him quite well because he was a great friend of my brother's, and in my job as Naval Secretary, I had very close ties with his executive assistant, who was a fellow called Tusker Wright from Montreal at that time. And we were always talking to each other on various things. Well, during this period, 47 to 50, when I was Naval Secretary, all sorts of things happened. We had the mutinies, so-called, the incidents. And they appointed a commission to investigate them because they suspected subversion, that the commies had got in. Actually, it was disproved. Mm-hmm. And the members of the commission were Rear Admiral Mingy, who was the chairman, L.W. Brockington, who was a rather outstanding character and broadcaster during the war, and had a son who'd been in the Navy in the VRs, and Louis Odette, who'd been a VR officer, but at that time he was a lawyer by profession and a very nice chap. He'd been CO of one of the frigates or corvettes or something during the war. And that was a very interesting period. We had other problems because the Air Force was trying desperately to put down and eliminate the Fleet Air Arm. And we were fighting with the Air Force the whole time, which added to the ginger of the whole thing.
What was the Navy's view on that subject?
Well,
Admiral Lear has some very, was very adamant about his opinions that the Navy should always be in control of its own air cover.
Well, certainly, in my opinion, there's no question that is right. Mm-hmm. The Air Force is a very fine organization, but their people are not trained for... I mean, there are all sorts of things that... the proof of the pudding was in the control of the Coastal Command in the British forces. It wasn't until Admiralty or the operational aspects were put under the control of the Navy that any progress was made at all. Now, the real pioneers in naval aviation were the Americans, who had developed aircraft carriers and everything. And what turned the whole thing around and stopped us losing the war in 1943 was when we were able to get air power to sea. That was in the small carriers, and also in the very long range aircraft that were acquired by Coastal Command and by the RCAF, Liberators and Cansos and things like that. And there was no question that if we were to be an anti-submarine navy, we had to have anti-submarine air. And we had problems developing it. Our first aircraft carrier was... we sort of cut our teeth on the Nabob and Puncher, but the first one that was Canadian was the Warrior. And she carried originally Seafire fighters, which were Spitfires with a slightly strengthened